Science is risk assessment and Jesus is call. Before we get into the end of what Jesus' side would be, we have to figure out what society determines is a reasonable exposure to chemicals that we put out in the environment. What is considered reasonable by society? Well, there's no one set belief, as most people know by the Mexican border. What's fine for the U.S. is different for Mexico, and state to state it differs to some degree. But basically it all starts out, somebody goes in and they put in a single chemical into one animal, okay? And they give it by different ways, they give it to them by mouth, and they give it to them inhalation and other things. And they figure out what amounts to a mortality curve, deaths or mortality or sickness, morbidity, and the percent of the population exposed. Now they can only generate a curve someplace between 1 out of 10 to 9 out of 10. That's all the data they get, really, reasonably. That's what you generate is the real data. Then you have to predict what that function looks like at lower amounts. And that's pretty hard. With some chemicals, they have established that there's an amount where you have to get to a certain amount, then it starts having a major effect. And there are other ones, they say, well, let's go back linear from that to estimate very low amounts. For example, the U.S. standard is 1 in 1 million. 1 out of 1 million people, if exposed over a lifetime, that means 70 years, will come down with cancer, for example, to a chemical. In Minnesota, it's 1 out of 100,000. The reason it's 1 out of 100,000 in Minnesota is because we're viewed as a very environmentally aware state, and therefore they don't want an industry to feel that we're too environmentally aware, and it would scare away industry. So they use a standard about 10 times that of the U.S. standard. How do they predict this? Well, They figure out climate stuff, you know, things on climate, and sometimes they don't have a close weather station. They try to figure out things on worst case. They consider worst case scenario, like if a 30 mile an hour wind were blowing through Holden all the time and blowing the dust up from the tailings. They go individual components, look what they were, and then they try to predict it for what they think would be the most susceptible population, which is probably pregnant women, and the effects on that. And then they come up with what they think would be a standard one, which would be like 1 out of 100,000, and they put your line right here and say, anything below this amount is okay. And unfortunately in mixtures, since they're testing single components, and there are 50 or 60,000 chemicals used regularly, they've only tested 20% of them. Everything else is a pretty much a theoretical guess from that, an educated guess from that basis. And there are millions of chemicals, but it's 50 or 60,000 are used commonly. So it's a pretty much a best guess scenario. And you can see that since they don't know what the shape of this curve is, there's a lot of argument. Industry would like us to think that it's this, and if we over-regulate and use this line, which industry said we do a lot of the time, a linear extrapolation back from feeding them over a lifetime, and that's a rat for 2 years, okay? Because that's a lifetime of a rat if you have no good human data. And then you bring in all sorts of uncertainty factors, like if it's a rat, you got to multiply by 40 for human, and then you got to, if it's not a long life, you got to multiply by 10 again. And the reason is, this is based, the amount this thing goes up is based on a logarithm of the dose. It's a logarithm function, not a straight linear function. So this is what you come up with, and it's 1 out of 100,000 or 1 over 1,000. Now, is it really 1 over 100 million or 1 over 100,000? If you go statistically and try to figure out how these things work, for example, I don't know if you've heard about dioxins and how terrible those things are. Well, they think they're more like this now than like these curves. And we've been, you know, regulating them like this based on the new scientific evidence. And yet for others, we may be underestimating the risks in the past of their problems. So in other words, a 1 in 100,000 may be anywhere between 1 in a million and 1 in 10,000 if it's a good guess. Or it could be 1 out of 100, or things like that. For example, in the state of Washington, there's a nuclear facility used for development of weapons-grade plutonium, Hanford nuclear facility. And they thought that if you were exposed to something called 5 rems per year of radiation, that that was okay. That was a good dose. Well, they were only exposed to 2 rems per year, and they had significantly elevated cancer rates over the rest of the population. So that was not a good, and still the standard, 5 per year is still the standard in the nuclear industry. And so what's the problem with this is that society has determined that even if it's correct that 1 out of 100,000 people or 1 out of 1,000,000 is okay. And in a city, pick a city the size of New York City, let's say we're talking about 10 million people. With 1 out of 100,000 people being affected, over a lifetime of exposure, you have, and this is addition to whatever their other risks are, just this one individual chemical being emitted from someplace, you're now exposing 100 people to a shorter lifetime who might have lived a longer lifetime because of it. Now, in societal terms, the economic benefit outweighs the risk to those 100 people. Yeah. You were saying? Oh, you just swatting?
I'm just amazed at flying.
Okay, that's fine. Lots of flies around. And that's...
Good question. Is there age or how many years that they would live longer or less?
This is based on a 70-year lifespan. But the their age...
It might be 65.
Yeah. But basically, that's how they determine some of the scientific stuff. But even if it's correct, which it isn't, I mean, it's only the best guess, and it can be off by an incredible margin. You know how bad we can weather forecast. We're trying to weather forecast over a 70-100-year period because we're talking about, you know, lifetime of exposure. And we know that children are more susceptible. For example, in pesticides, the first 5 years of life, you'll get 35% of your pesticides that you'll ever see into your body. If children are more susceptible. How about poor poverty? Hunger, interestingly enough, we had the hunger meal. Hunger is probably one of the key things in increasing the risk factor. For example, if you're exposed to a tailings pond, let's say it had some lead in, you will take in more tailings if you ate it. Let's say you got in your food, blew into your food and you ate it. You'll take in more tailings by a considerable margin for those who are children versus adults. It can be even 35% more in children. Then, or even more than that, then you go up and you say, well, what happens if the children aren't getting enough milk, not enough calcium? They'll take up lead as if it were calcium. It's the same sort of chemical characteristic. And so they'll even take up that much more. So we know the most susceptible populations are going to be those who live closest to these areas, those who are likely to be already in poverty and nutritionally deficient. And lead is one of the biggies. Because if you think about it, where might our biggest lead problems come from? Well, they have kids living in old houses with parents that aren't watching them and are eating the pica, the lead off the side of the, from their window panes. They can't afford to repaint. They're already nutritionally down. That's why they're eating the pica probably the first place. They're just hungry to begin with. And then they're more susceptible to whatever comes in the window, and they're likely to live near the heavy industry. For example, years ago in Philadelphia, we had a guy that was called the Tooth Fairy in Philly, a guy named Shapiro. And he went out from the dental school and collected all the teeth from these kids. And he also collected soil around the paint factories. And he found that socioeconomically you can predict highest lead levels in their teeth based on the poverty level, except for one Catholic school where the paint was flaking off the lunchroom ceiling and into their food. However, he found close to the paint factories where these poor people live, if he looked at the soil, 50% of it was lead. You could refine the lead levels out of the soil when they were manufacturing paint those years ago. That gives you some of the idea of why this risk assessment thing doesn't really perfectly work. Those most likely at risk will more likely be affected by it. For example, we can say, Don't eat the fish in the Minnesota River because there's too much PCBs in them. But who goes fishing there? Most likely the Vietnamese refugees and things like that. They'll go in and they try to take my fish from my studies. I say, I can't give you these fish. I can't ethically give you these fish. Go eat something else, you know. If you can. If not, I'll give you some money for food, or we have food for friends downtown or something. Go there. But no, they go fishing, they eat it. Not thinking that this fish could be highly contaminated because they're hungry, that's also a more staple diet, and fish is expensive, and you'll find people fishing in the Hudson River, all over the place. If they can catch it, they'll eat it because they're hungry. It's part of the way they live with it. So these risk factors scientifically look great. They look good. They look like, over a lifetime exposure, 1 in 100,000. But it's always the poor. It's always the young. It's always the pregnant women who don't have enough care. So we're always pointing it to those people. Okay? Now, on a societal benefit, you'll say, wait a second, economically, to get to really low levels, which won't affect anybody, we can't do it. We just can't bring it down to zero anymore. And to get it close to that, it would cost us a fortune. For example, this is not an easy thing to determine. You could say, well, we shouldn't do anything with polluting. Well, years ago, they found out that the chloride, vinyl chloride, that they make all the PVC pipe out of, it's a vinyl chloride, becomes a polymer, polyvinyl chloride. And the monomer, this stuff, is extremely cancer-causing, extremely so. And the plastics industry, the EPA said, you're working at levels in your factories that are guaranteed to give your workers cancer. We should shut down this $1 trillion-a-year industry. Well, the economic destruction that would occur from that, and from all the jobs lost of a $1 trillion-a-year industry, would be so severe, the hardships would be so great, and possibly the government could collapse, all sorts of things could happen. You just can't do that, because what you're going to wind up doing is you're going to put everybody out of work, and you create such an uproar. Yeah?
But Steve, the same thing too with the tobacco industry, and the same thing is true with the alcohol industry.
But guess what they did? They came with a compromise. Somebody smart in the plastic industry said, next year will be tenfold lower than that. And the next year will be tenfold lower, and the next year will be tenfold lower, and we're going to give protection to our workers. We're going to protect those workers that are at higher levels. And we'll get down to your standard.
I'm not talking about the workers. I'm talking about the consumers.
I understand.
Our economic situation is so crucial, or maybe, I don't know if that's a word I want to use, in having people employed, that they're not going to give you all the facts on what smoking causes in relationship to cancer.
Yeah.
Because the business could just not shut down. Well, it's just like the PVC, like you say, the amount of money, if you just shut that down.
Right.
Just take a look, Chrysler is a fairly good illustration. Mm-hmm. We bail out Chrysler. Mm-hmm. And look at the jobs that it saved. And the tobacco business is bigger than Chrysler.
You see, that's the problem. The problem is, if you shut it down just like that, knowing the bad causes, the bad you will cause in those regions may be so severe that you may have rioting and killings and death in high amounts by that thing. So you have to phase things in, knowing full well that keeping it going is going to injure a few or more than a few. Yes.
One of the things here, even like the fish. Now, I'll fish in Lake Superior, mm-hmm. and what they say is, sure, there's contaminants in the fish, but it doesn't harm you. All you have to do is you just only eat so many.
Yeah, but you can't tell that to the eagles.
To the what?
Eagles. You can't tell the eagles that.
No, but I mean, you were saying like the Vietnamese eat the fish. Well, it won't hurt them as long as they don't have too many.
But you can't tell them that because they won't believe you, and furthermore, they're hungry. So they're not going to listen to your guidelines. You can go in and catch a fish if you're doing it for a hobby, and you say, I'll only eat a fish a month or something. But those who need it as a staple of their diet and can't afford to will go down and fish beyond their limit. Because there's nobody there saying, wait a second, how many fish have you had? Let's see, there's nobody really that can control that. So basically you are given that, and the animals will be affected. You see, you're also infecting animals. because you can't tell eagles to stop eating it. You know, you'd like to put a sign, eagles, please only eat one fish a month, and then go fly elsewhere and eat some other stuff, like some mice or something. But that's part of the problem. I mean, part of the problem is that. Now, you say, well, how severe can this be? When you put pesticides down, okay, you wouldn't believe the bee kills that occur. And if the bees get wiped out, you're not going to have any crops, because you're not going to have any pollination. And they used to have a supplement in apiary, for apiaries around Minnesota. The supplement's being kicked out, saw as one of those things that we don't need anymore. It's one of those boondoggle pork barrel things. Well, with no incentive anymore, the beekeeper's going to get sick of having the bees killed off every time a pesticide spray 3 miles away. And so they may not start keep them up anymore. So therefore, they may have major crop failures, which they hadn't anticipated. So this is just part of this risk assessment thing that we start off with. And that's the scientific risk assessment. That is, if you buy into societies that 1 in 100,000 or 1 in 1,000,000 is okay, even if those numbers are correct, you're assuming that. Now let's see what Jesus says about it, because we have two possibilities here in dealing with it, or maybe more than that, and that's what we need to discuss here. Let's see what Jesus' call is. Noting that those most susceptible are likely to be children who are hungry, and that we are sacrificing a few for the good of the many. At least that's the assumptions. I'm going to read from Matthew. I'm going to try to read as completely as possible, so not to read out of context. Chapter 25, 31 through...
End of the chapter.
That's right. Thank you very much. I knew it. When the Son of Man comes in His glory and all the angels with Him, then He will sit on His glorious throne. Before Him will be gathered all the nations, and He will separate them one from another as a shepherd separates the sheep from the goats. He will place the sheep at His right hand, but the goats at the left. Then the King will say to those at the King's right hand, "Come, O blessed of my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. For I was hungry, and you gave me food. I was thirsty, and you gave me drink. I was a stranger, and you welcomed me. I was naked, and you clothed me. I was sick, and you visited me. I was in prison, and you came to me." Then the righteous will answer, "Lord, when did we see thee hungry and feed thee, or thirsty and give thee drink? And when did we see thee a stranger and welcome thee, or naked and clothe thee? And when did we see thee sick or in prison and visit thee?" And the King will answer them, "Truly I say to you, as you did it to one of the least of these, my brethren, you did it to me." Then He will say to those at His left hand, "Depart from me, you cursed, into the eternal fire, prepared for the devil and his angels. For I was hungry, and you gave me no food. I was thirsty, you gave me no drink. I was a stranger, and you did not welcome me. Naked, and you did not clothe me. Sick and in prison, you did not visit me." Then they will also answer, "Lord, when did we see thee hungry, or thirsty, or a stranger, or naked, or sick in prison, and did not minister to thee?" Then He will answer to them, "Truly I say to you, as you did not to one of the least of these, you did it not to me." And it will go away into eternal punishment, but the righteous into eternal life. And that's the first one. And the second one I'd like to read is from Matthew 18, 10 through 14. "See that you do not despise one of these little ones. For I tell you that in the heaven their angels always behold the face of my Father who is in heaven. What do you think? If a person has 100 sheep, and one of them has gone astray, does that person not leave the 99 on the mountains and go in search of the one that went astray? And if that finds it, truly I say to you, that person rejoices over it more than over the 99 that never went astray. So it will of my Father who is in heaven, that one of these little ones should perish." We're faced with a whole nother risk assessment that we hadn't before. Jesus looks at the 1 in 100,000 and says, especially of these little ones, do not let them perish. And yet we know from the way we do the science that it is the little ones that perish. The question is, what do we do? We have a couple choices, but what do we do?
What are the choices, Steve?
Okay, one choice is to leave it as it is. In other words, knowing that it'd be economically unfruitful. Knowing that it'd be economically unfruitful to go there, we are sacrificing a portion of our population if we don't get them adequate nutrition, etc. I mean, certainly we can try to build in nutrition programs and all. Certainly we can try to locate some of these sites elsewhere, but it's really difficult. We can go and minister to those children and to those families and, you know, apologize for the rest of society knowing that they are the sacrifice. They are our sacrifice for our lifestyle, for our society. They are the Good Friday sacrifice, effectively. I mean, we're putting them there, and we're telling them they are the sacrifice. The person who has cancer from smoking is a sacrifice for the tobacco industry doing so well, who gets cancer. Again, all these, we go to each any industry and say, this is the sacrifice we are paying. And be with them and comfort them and comfort their families. And that's the one possibility. In other words, assuming it'll always be there. The second possibility is stop looking at the short term and start looking more at the long term, realizing that we can phase in a cleanup where we can do better and use less. Who says we have to generate peak power?
Then we'd have to decide who or which country or which nation we're working on helping, and are we wanting to help a whole nation or sparsely help many nations
in the
process?
Sure.
What I would think is that you would stay with a problem and try to solve that.
Mm-hmm.
And you talk about power. I wouldn't talk about power. I talk about food.
Mm-hmm.
And I talk about my industry. We raise food.
Mm-hmm.
But we are on the organic method of farming now. I still know this. We still use insecticide and pesticides.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we talk about feeding our population and we've got to produce more food. I just don't know, Steve, that we can produce more food and not still rely on chemicals. And I don't care if you use chemicals, it's going to get into the food. There's just no way out. I don't know to what proportions, but it's going to be there. So what are you going to do? We're going to feed the people.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to try to feed the people.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we've got to use chemicals. If we don't use chemicals, what are the solutions so that we can feed the people and still not have people dying because of?
Mm-hmm. Well,
you see the dilemma?
Well, some of the dilemma is how much food is being raised for feeding animals and versus how much is being raised for feeding people. If it were all, in other words, if we ate like Holden most of the time, how much more could we raise, and how much chemicals would we have to use? I mean, there are...
I think one of the things, though, Jared, is that there is enough food in the world. Part of the problem is the distribution of it.
Mm-hmm.
There is enough food in the world. And I was in...
I don't know.
Right. I don't know. I mean, I don't know either in terms of person, you know,
but
I understand that's what I read.
Yeah.
And I do know that, like, when I was in Africa, in East Africa, And I saw what people were growing, and one of the first questions I asked was, why are they growing this? Because what they were growing was coffee and tea and bananas.
Well, blame American industry for that.
Well, they blamed the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank, which had mandated export crops in order to pay the interest on the huge loans that the government had drawn in order to build its military machine. And, you know, and this process, there was plenty of land there for food.
Mm-hmm.
But it was being used for export industries rather than for internal, for crops for domestic consumption.
Go ahead, please.
Well, I was going to say to his two choices, I don't think we have a choice. I think we have to take the second one, and through time we make changes You know, if I were a tobacco farmer today, I'd be looking at some other crops to raise, even though for generations it's been my thing.
It's a heck of a lot less profitable.
Look, well, sure. And look at the automobile industry. Look at the automobile emissions now. And when we, you know, back 20, 30 years ago, there's no way we can do what we're doing now.
But plus, in addition to the chrome, the tobacco, it's an optional. You're not forcing it in the environment for the most part. I mean, there's all kinds of crap about the smoke, but the people are optionally choosing to smoke.
Except in third world countries where it's being foisted on children and targeted. Yeah. And that's where most of the profits are being made.
It's the same way in our country.
Yeah. I know.
It's
targeted too. The Camel's ad, I mean, that is targeted at kids. What's his face?
No. Joe. The Marlboro, the horse and the
rider. The horse and the rider is targeted young adults.
You better believe it.
But that stupid Camel man, whatever his, you know who I mean?
Yeah.
He is really targeted at teens and preteens, very specifically.
You could do it in your church, though. For example, find out what kind of bulbs they're using in your church.
Kind of what?
Bulbs.
Light bulbs.
Oh. Mm-hmm. Use those with very low wattage, like ones that generate 50 watts and use two or something like that. If we place them all, now they're expensive to begin with.
That's right.
But if you can replace them slowly, just one at a time, when one blows, put the one in, and get, maybe you need a fund to do that. You'll be surprised how you save on the bills and therefore don't need to generate peak stuff. Because the more we replace, if a whole town replaces all their bulbs with lower wattage, starts having shades to keep the sun off in the summertime and has more passive solar in the wintertime, all that sort of thing, we could generate, the electric industry go crazy because they wouldn't know what to do with all the electricity.
Well, they do. They raise our rates promptly.
Yeah. That might be the way of... But there would be the need for, they wouldn't have to argue, well, we need to have all these nuclear plants.
You know, you talked about what we can do in our churches, and that's fine. We can educate ourselves. We're all church-going people. We all are active in our congregations. But we live in a valley where our congregation would be very, very, very few smokers.
Right.
They would go for most of the environmental things. Mm-hmm. But all around us are the unchurched.
Right.
And they're poor. And they're the ones who are buying the alcohol and the tobacco. Mm-hmm. And when I'm sitting at the desk in the food bank, working with the hungry people who come in, they reek of tobacco smoke. Mm-hmm. And those of us who are churched, who are responsible and so on, are not smoking. Mm-hmm. Now, how do you reach all those people? How do you convince them not to spend the money that they could spend on food, on tobacco, and that type of thing? How do you convince them not to... to buy less expensive light bulbs or bulbs that are going to last a lot longer? We have a big educational problem in front of us.
That's right.
You've been trying to talk for 5 minutes.
not to be fatalistic, mm-hmm. and to sound fatalistic, but we solve the food problem, and the automatic outcome of solving the food problem is going to be a larger population to feed. One of the things that we constantly are running into, we solve one part of the problem, and we almost automatically create another problem. We stop the smoking industry, we automatically create a poverty situation. We shut down a group of plants someplace, and we automatically create another difficulty. And if we create the poverty situation, you increase the drinking and the smoking, because it's from the examples that we're using, those are the kinds of things that happen. Out of stress, these people who don't have turn that direction. That's where the frustration for me is. You know, it's not a simple, we pick out one area and take it. Because as soon as we solve the problem, we in turn create two and three more, it seems like sometimes.
How in the world did we have such a smooth transition right after World War II to go from a war industry to a civilian industry. I mean, here's growing that went from airplanes to canoes, and you know, that's an oversimplification. We did it once, why can't we do it again?
It's more pervasive now.
A couple things are occurring. First, to start off with the idea of the science risk estimate, that this risk thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
How are we going off to the all the social thing, if that's legal and that's great. Right. Okay, it's a different sort of different topic, right?
Mm-hmm.
And if also, when the lifespan was 20, 30 years or something like that, 35 years of age, right? Here we're talking about 65 years of age. Do you trade things off like this to say what is, and what is optional and what is, you know, and Gary, I agree with him about the population, right? Mm-hmm. Well, I think every pound of food that goes overseas ought to have two condoms with it or something like this, okay? And my simplistic view of life,
but,
okay?
But again, so, do we have the right to put that kind of risk assessment on those people?
What risk assessment? What are you saying?
What are you talking about?
Yeah.
I mean, do we have the right to, number one, morally push that kind of population control, whatever you want to call it, on these people? Is that all right? I don't think it is.
Keep them from starving, it seems to me like it, it's a
but
good
it, the food is great, but can we, and do we have the right, even within our own country, we have a fight of whether we can put a condom in a classroom or in a school building to protect our own children from AIDS?
I think, again, I'm drawing on my experience, my limited experience overseas. When I was in Africa, the problem was not the availability of a condom. It was male attitudes towards procreational control and Roman Catholic Church attitudes towards the whole issue. And I, you know, I'm not Catholic, but I have very dear friends that are, and the Roman Catholic Church is one of the biggest stumbling blocks worldwide to this, the whole issue of population control and family size control. You know, and that's an issue that has yet to be adequately addressed. But in terms of, like, after World War II, and we're doing several things at once.
Yeah.
After World War II, after 1945, this country went into a nosedive depression. Mm-hmm. And that depression lasted, and it was very, very severe. It lasted until the announcement and then the unrolling of the Marshall Plan, which was several $1 billion worth of money spent to help people.
We have to spend the money.
We're going to have to spend a lot of money.
Sure.
That's how we got out of the Depression in the 30s. We spent the money.
On the war.
That's how we got out of the Depression after the war, was spending that money on Europe and Japan.
But it's going to take money. Somebody's got to be willing to spend that money for that transition.
Well, we've gotten out of the Depression, quotes, of 1970 by spending money, too. Now we're out of spending money. I'm starting to get a feeling for, hold on a second. I'm starting to get a feeling for that a lot of people are seeing a complexity of issues, that one issue rolls into the next, and it's so intertwined that it's not science anymore. Frankly, it didn't start as science to begin with. This kind of science is not the best science can do, because it's not a very good predictor. And the second thing is, determining that 1 in 1 million or 100,000 is an acceptable limit is not a scientific decision.
That's a social decision.
That is a social decision, and we're realizing it right now. Society can decide that 1 out of 100 is okay, 1 out of 10's okay, or every woman is okay, as it seems to be in China. You know, every woman child is okay to out the door. That's their risk assessment plan. And so it's a social decision. Once we realize that, we will not put it back in the scientist's hand. The scientists can only give you so much. And you realize that society and religion should be the one, the religious community should be the one, and you ask, how can we do it as a small congregation? I think a congregation, the words that speak to me out of the Bible is, let your light so shine before others. Because I've heard a lot of talk, but we don't talk Jesus anymore. Well, people are sick of Jesus talk, If there's nothing to back it up. If your congregation is looked at and say, my gosh, you're saving money. And how do you feed all these people? And you're serving all this food and you get all this tithing because all these people are saving money because they're all eating vegetarian. And, you know,
Wow!
And you're still happy, and you feel good.
Right, and you know...
I mean, that's important, I'm not to deny...
Yeah, and not only that, you're living in America, and you're not, you know, you're all just... I think that is the beginning of it, and then inviting them in and saying, you don't have to come into... It's an evangelical thing to do. I mean, when they look at, they're going to wander in the church and go, what are you selling here? What are you selling here? I mean, this is pretty good stuff. And you say, hey, I used to eat that back in my country, you know? Or, yeah, beans, oh yeah, that's a good, you know. And you say, well, sorry, the church is not, is a no-smoking place. We can't allow you to smoke in here. For a while, there are all their alternatives. You say, you know, I quit smoking, and there's a lot of witnessing that can go on. There's just tons of it. But it's first got to start at the level of the community that's pushing it. You know, a lot of scientists say, well, this is what we should be doing, taking consulting money, and smoking a cigarette, and, you know, driving a big car that's the gas is belching out the back. Intellectually, the academics love to come at it intellectually. Intellectually, I don't know if you've heard the joke, but you're stuck on a desert island with a normal sort of person of society, an engineer and an academic. And the normal person's trying to get, they're only cans there on this island that wash the sore with you. The normal person's taking a rock and trying to beat the heck out of them, trying to open it. The engineer's got it on a rock, trying to have the thermal expansion open it up by itself. And the professor's sitting there saying, assume a can opener. So, you know, and that's generally where we wind up being, assuming a can opener. Instead of just noticing that we can do a lot of witnessing by starting to do these things. In my own house, I'm starting to replace all the bulbs. Do you know what a pain it is? Those damn things don't fit in a socket. They start to drag it out of the ceiling, and you go, my gosh, it's not going to all fit. I have to choose my lamps differently. But I don't like those lamps. They're not nice looking.
Spend more money on a new type of lamp and get rid of the old one, so you've got some waste.
Yeah, well, we haven't yet. I've started jewelry rigging these darn things. But you learn to live without the globes. You say, it looks nice without the globe. You know, it doesn't look so nice, but I'm going to start thinking that looks good enough without the globe. And you start doing things like that in your own home. But it's a real pain. I mean, it really becomes a pain, but you really learn.
But that still isn't the example that a lot of the unchurched people are going to see. And I'm going to go back to your statement on birth control for a second, too. The very same people that I mentioned who come into our food bank reeking of smoke, okay, are the ones, you know, in the community, we hear, why are these poor women having so much children? What's the matter with these women? It isn't the women. It's the men who come home drunk, beat up the woman, and she gets pregnant again. And that's why a lot of these poor people are pregnant. They have these children.
Invite the men into the church. I mean,
those men don't even get out of the car.
Right.
When they drive up to the food bank, it's a woman who comes out into the food bank,
right,
carries the bottle. Well, we have to carry it out to the truck or to the pickup truck, while the guy sits behind the wheel and just watches.
Because he's so ashamed.
No, it's yes, macho. It's no, he isn't.
That's we he's know. Macho because uh-huh. he's ashamed.
Not the ones we know. Darren, no.
Well, there may be some. There may be some.
There's some of that.
In that.
There's
might
some
be some.
Of that.
I know my father was very authoritarian because he felt so low about his own self. He couldn't deal with the idea that he only had an 8th grade education and all, and that bothered him in this society. But I mean, no matter what the reason is, somehow we got to affect Jesus' risk assessment. In other words, realizing that this is a social statement. There is no science in here. The science stopped at that 1 out of 10. That's when the science stopped. Because if you think you can predict the weather, you're out of your mind. If you think you can predict the 100-year or 300-year water, you know, rainfall, you're out of your mind. You can't predict these things. Our weather has been so good this century, nobody knows how variable weather can get in other times. If we start going back to a glacial period, people see weather shifts like they wouldn't believe. That's why there's so much argument of whether how much the weather is going to change when the CO2 goes up. Because the predictors are not good predictors. We have so much error built in, we don't know what the curve looks like. And that's only for one chemical. Try to put a bunch of them together in mixtures as it's really coming out of real things, and you become... it's not a hopeless situation, but it's a very difficult one, and it's too expensive to have scientists figure it out for real.
I think when some of this stuff we're talking about, there's two different groups, in a sense, that are victims here.
Mm-hmm.
And in one group are people who are victims because they have no choice.
Mm-hmm.
And an example that you used is the small children eating lead.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Paint and the window molding,
mm-hmm.
caulking. And they have no choice as children. And I personally am convinced that for the most part, our culture has abandoned children. In the sense that we have abandoned the generation, our children, to the mercies of a two-parent family, or a one-parent family, or a no-parent family, and have said, hey, that's the way it's supposed to be. And we provided no serious form of social safety net, to use an American term, to protect those children on any real way. The other victim, you know, I do see the Canadian medical system as far superior to the American, by the way, health system. The other thing is those people who voluntarily subject themselves and indirectly others to it, and that is drinkers and smokers.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody forces you to smoke. I mean, I understand you can be addicted. There's no question of that. My father is an alcoholic, and he is addicted to alcohol, and that's, I think at this point in his life, irredeemable, within some limits. And as long as there's life, there's hope, and there are miracles. But that is something that is relatively voluntary.
Well, unless we think of it as a racist targeting. Mm-hmm. After all, where are the malt liquors being drugged? And what are the ones that are targeted to
mm-hmm. okay.
black populations? And, you know, you don't even see that stuff in most neighborhoods. You know, the really heavy malt liquors. And they come in the 40-ouncers. Mm-hmm. You will not find that in your, you know, you'll find that in those neighborhoods because they target them. And how about smokes without filters on them?
Almost exclusively to the poorer neighborhoods.
Again, there's a targeting that goes on. So we go back almost to the environmental racism again. They know what it's like down there, and they are willing to target. After all, we not only pushed, let's go back to the people who originally had this land. The people who originally had this land, the first thing we did after we pushed them off the land is we introduced them to alcohol, you know, and lots of it.
We introduced them to alcohol so that we could more effectively push them off.
That's right.
Yeah.
But I mean, and therefore, it's also, but I mean, there's a lot of that, you know,
yes.
there's a lot of that kind of...
And with the Bible.
so we have, but it's not a hopeless thing. It really isn't a hopeless. I hear what you're saying. It's not hopeless. And we really have to realize that when we back up this, let's back up. Back up to this risk assessment stuff. When you hear experts come down and say, scientists have determined that based on the risk assessment, okay, that it's okay. It's okay to have this facility here. You have to turn around and go, wait a second. Who's around here? Who lives here? And you got to look for those lost sheep. You got to look for those lost sheep. You got to look for the young ones. You go and find out where the daycare centers are, or where people can't even send their kids to daycare centers. You got to look for those lost sheep. You got to look for that and go back and say, your risk assessment is it's mine. And you have the right to protest and write and or change a point of view. All of this is possible. And at the same time, show that your consumption, etc., is going down, that Holden's having an influence on your life, although it's hard. My gosh, our kids give us trouble. You know, and society's giving them trouble because they're being told by the TV set, which we probably should throw out the window, you know.
Here, here.
I mean, we're told by the TV set that they should be consuming more and turning it on more. And they have increased your electrical consumption by all the stereos, etc. Eat all that good burger food because it tastes really good. You know, beef is for real people, and you know, and real food, and you know, and you go down the line, and you find increased consumption, increased use, increased power. It leads to all these problems where all the industries show up their hands and say, "You're asking for it. You've been asking for more power all along. You've been asking for this. You've been asking for that." Budweiser says now, "Drink within moderation." You know,
Everybody wants to get in the act of, I'm reasonable, you're the ones that are unreasonable. Okay? And yet the ads still say the opposite. So it really goes back, and when we start doing this risk assessment stuff, the Bible has a lot to say. And we tend to take ourselves out of the picture because we get all the scientific gobbledygook thrown at us and say, you don't know any better, you're just church people. You're just a bunch of ignorant church people who don't know nothing, okay? And that's what we're told. We're told you don't know anything. And yet a lot of the church people have scientific backgrounds because it's not a scientific decision. It's not ever been a scientific decision. It's always been a social one. Mm-hmm. And if you expose it and say, I know what risk assessment is, you're assuming that in this state, one of 100,000 people over a lifetime can be exposed and that's okay, and that's assuming that your guess is on. I'm saying, no, it's not okay, I don't like it, and I know who that 100,000 person is going to be. And they say, well, you're going to affect the economics, and so you say, well, you tell me what the costs actually are, and maybe I'll sit down and write a check for it. Okay? But I mean, you got to challenge the assumptions, and that's the basis of it, because otherwise, the utility commissions and all will rule. You'll just, you know, we always throw it in their lap and say, you make the decisions for us.
There is a need then for a lot more openness than what we currently enjoy in our society. And the fact of the matter is you have to push and you have to dig to find out the information that in fact is public information.
That's right.
The people who benefit from secrecy really need to be examined closely.
But the public information is not available to the public.
No, it's not.
Oh, it isn't, but boy, I'll let you know that I was a scientist brought in to fight something, and then one public person, who also is an organic farmer, she, I would call a pit bull. I mean, she is not the scientist, but she comes into the university all the time and gets information. And she goes up to the public utility, you know, she goes up to the pollution control agency up in St. Paul, and she just sits there and gnaws on their leg till they don't want to deal with her anymore. And then they'll give her the information. And then she goes down to the industry and challenges this and challenges that and keeps educating herself. I'm telling you, I mean, this person, I mean, you wonder where the energy comes from. Sooner or later, you know, she's going to fall over. But she just doesn't let go. And she has challenged a big utility and taken it on and done pretty well for, you know, somebody that didn't know anything. But boy, you can really make an effect. And I found that my appearance at it was the only reason they like to believe me. Most of these boards are not composed of even pollution control agencies are not composed of scientists. They're composed of people appointed by governors and things like that who do rely on the scientific staff. So I come in with some credibility because I got something after my name. Right. But then I start talking, not science, I start talking fairness. You start talking morality and fairness and who's around there and people's rights and things like that. And they listen to that. They listen to children and they listen to parents who are concerned and they listen and they say, and you have to listen too. They tell the industry and they tell that to your staff that you have to listen and you have to listen to their concerns. And you have watchdogs who sit there. Little old ladies are the best watchdogs. They look out their windows all the time and they see the smokestack go, and they get on the phone. I smell a stink and it's there. You know, they're the best prevention. And you know, you've got lots of them in your congregation. You know, we call them the little old ladies sewing circle and terrorist group. You know, yeah. You know, they're just... You know, they're your best, you know, we have the nuns up on the hill are the best. I mean, we have a School Sisters of Notre Dame, fabulous group of old nuns. Boy, they came down in wheelchairs and everything. I mean, they're just incredibly, that's what it takes. And people get so, I don't know what it is, but it's taken out of their system. Their soul is sucked out. Like, you know, I have no ability to deal with it. We need to empower them again. Empower it with the, you know, the words of the Bible that say, you can look after the little sheep and you can be empowered, you can go forth and you don't have to believe the crap of the Pharisees, you know? You just don't have to take their crap. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But some of the parts that bother me that a lot of the people who take a little bit of knowledge and a lot of fear, such I believe is in the nuclear industry, okay, that a lot more people die from pollution from coming out of coal fired smokestacks than will ever die out of nuclear, you know, radiation.
Unless they have a Chernobyl.
Yeah, but you got to realize that's a different world over there.
It is. You know how close we came in 3 Mile Island? You want me to tell you what actually happened there? They formed a hydrogen bubble that almost exploded. Mm-hmm. They melted down 50% of the reactor core. it was melted down 50%, plus the cancer rates are not being,
that's right,
are not being honestly evaluated, because the environmental scientist who works next to me said that the cancer rates are pretty extraordinary if you don't factor out a lot of crap that's been factored out. So we've been lied to again and again about this problem.
Okay, but have you, what about the people?
Oh, I know.
Some of the smokestacks and...
All of it's bad. All of it's bad. Okay. But we could probably generate it all by wind power and solar power, etc., if we all wouldn't consume so much. Slowly. Not tomorrow. Not
okay,
the next
I guess I'd like to hear a vision of your future.
The vision,
the vision
of, the,
of your future, 50 years from now. What's the
vision of future? Is you may have superconducting lines through everything. Mm-hmm. You have passive solar.
And where does all that come from? That comes from power, moving into research, doing stuff.
Possibly, like, yeah. Of course, there's going to be some of that, but there's going to be superconductors. We're going to use some of the technology, and we're going to use some old technologies. Like, people are going to go passive solar. Government agencies are going to stop replacing, you know, all their bulbs with, you know, low, or they're going to just turn off every second one. You know, there's all sorts of things are going to happen that people can consume less. Some of the technologies are going to help us. Instead of having newspapers, we might have, our TVs might have a switch on them to look at a newspaper. You will subscribe to a newspaper TV so that all the paper, the energy that goes into producing newspapers is incredible in cutting down all that timber.
How much consumption will be, how much will it be cut down? 50%?
Even if it's reduced 50%, that would be an enormous saving.
Semiconductors, as you know, would be
by then, any
way to tell.
The population will have doubled. Mm-hmm. So
and
we
again,
factor that in.
Okay, yes, that's right. But again, you have to be working at all different levels. Yeah. You've got to elevate the women, at least their sense of themselves.
We've got to change our lifestyle, too.
Exactly, but that's what the church is all about. I mean, the church is that social contract.
The church has got to change that book that's on your lap.
No. I can go back to Genesis. It said men and women are created equal.
You get us a really big discussion.
But that's the important. But that's important to have in the churches.
But that's...
Let's have those discussions.
Yeah.
But that book is what has given man.
And you mean with
the male dominance over the female,
or the interpretation?
I don't quite think you got the full line on that. No. And I think we all need to hear again the Babylonian creation story, because we don't have it anymore, but we all live it. That is to say, the dominant portion of our society lives that story and ignores what is written in Genesis 1, most specifically. And because we are intent on domination and power and the restoration of order from on high, because evil is disruption from below, and you just carry that into the Bible real easy. You don't even see the stuff that doesn't belong. You don't see what's written in Genesis 1, because you've already got it up here in your head, a whole different story. And our culture has been living with it. And that's what drives us. That's what makes us go the way we go.
And we have that. And I also heard, to add to that, which is a statement we all have to think about, Lowell Erdahl, Bishop of the St. Paul Synod, said that we don't read the Bible out of context. You have to read it through the life of Jesus.
Right.
And the life of Jesus was always woman-affirming. Not only a woman, but outside group. I mean, he was pointing to the women and saying, this Samaritan woman has more going on the ball. A woman with an uncovered head, can you imagine in an Arab country, a woman with an uncovered head, what they're viewed as? In those days, it was viewed the same. She not only had an uncovered head, she was washing his feet with her hair. They must have thought it was a sexual act back then. And yet he said that she was more than. He was always, when he let that woman go for adultery, what did he scribble in the sand? Some of the theologians said that he wrote in the sand, where's the man?
Where's
the guy? So Jesus has always said, has never, and one woman, she said, stop cooking, come listen. He's always pulled women, if we view the Bible through the life of Jesus as we interpret the rest of the Bible, we will find that there is none of that in his life. It has been written in by others. Please.
Okay, well, if you
want
to finish
up this,
I was going to do something different. I was going to add,
and who were the people who were told, the first people after the resurrection, told to go and tell? The ones he could trust, the women.
And they were with
the faithful ones.
And they were there through the crucifixion.
Yeah.
Although the guys would have probably been killed right off.
I guess, but he asked about what is your vision of the future, and you responded, and I guess I have some real questions or problems with that whole thing. I guess I have some vague visions of what the future might be, but I don't worry about the future. For me, at least, my job and my joy and my task is to correct what I see as wrong right now. Mm-hmm. And the future, if I'm faithful, the future will take care of itself.
Well, pray that you correct it correctly.
There's only one thing you can be absolutely sure of, and that is if you do nothing, we got hell on earth.
Mm-hmm. See, that's nice.
I agree with
what you think is the best now.
Yes, the thing is correct. Your vision is correct here as well as here. Yeah. In other words, we got to be as careful as possible. At the same point, we know what the results of not doing anything are too. And that'll link into tomorrow, where I'm going to go from there, is what is the current advocacy of the church and where do we get kicked in the teeth for it? I mean, we do have some things going, and we do go for certain positions. And you could get really lively when you realize what some of those positions are. But realizing that the church has to do what Luther said, which is go forth and sin boldly, because there's no way we can go forward and do always the right thing. But we know when we see that we're doing the wrong thing, we of the church hopefully have the ability to forgive ourselves and back off and say, I was wrong. You were right. Back off what I said to do and go your way.
But we have to. I certainly didn't mean to imply not to do anything. I just
no, but I understand. But you understand that when no matter what we do, it's always there's always going to be the saint and the sinner involved in all of
it. There's a risk.
And the risk is we're always going to be human. So
okay, our church started to do some things, you know, about that peak thing you were talking about. Well, okay, so we put in an electric furnace, mm-hmm. all right, and it only operates. That's supposed to eliminate the peak. Okay. They gave it to us free, mm-hmm. and so it's now costing us less money, so we're running the electric furnace all the time. Mm-hmm. And like last winter, really it only got shut off 3 times all winter because it wasn't cold enough.
Right.
Okay, so we're doing something about the peak, but what's happening in our area, everybody's putting electric furnaces because right now it's so cheap, just like electric water heaters.
Right.
Okay, but so our church looked at that. And I told him, I said, well, you can do what you want, but I'd say don't put in two units, put in one. Mm-hmm. Okay, I called this guy from the power company. He said, okay, you put in two of our units, but they're so cheap, they're only going to last 6 years, and you throw them out, and you're going to get mm-hmm. two more units like that. So I thought, well, I'd rather go out and buy a decent one that's going to last me 20 years, mm-hmm. because that's the other problem.
Yes.
So I'm helping the peak, but I'm dumping all the garbage.
But there are probably ways of fixing that as well. I mean, that's what part of it is. I mean, we always are modifying to get, the main thing is to stop consuming in the first place. I mean, if you shut off the furnace like they do in China, I mean, you live cold, but you live without the consumption. How can you approach that? Just turning the thermostat down and saying, is that okay? Turn it down a half a degree. Is that still okay? And for those who need a little warmer, maybe a little space heater is better. I mean, in one room. Part of it is everybody's approach taken together with the idea that we're looking at the lost sheep. We're not saying that continuing the way we are, it's okay to kill off a certain percent of their society. We're worrying about those, not like us, who are doing much better, but those who aren't. That's the call, I think.
I guess I've never seen too many futuristic movies, right? And some of which of these things of the future is pretty dismal, right? From, mm-hmm. You know, Escape from New York to, you know, Soylent Green, right? Mm-hmm. And, or to a version of the world that's pretty scientific called, like, Star Trek.
Right.
And it looks like to me you're hanging right in there going either way. Mm-hmm. And for if you take the whole world as a whole, okay? And particularly when you run out of oil in 50 to 100 years, mm-hmm. there's all kinds of things that are going to happen. It's going to get real nasty. And even if you cut it down, your whole consumption, you add another 30 years on it, 50 years on the allocation, you're still going to run out of it, unless you do an incredible amount of work. So I guess I'm looking at worrying that, hey, I'd rather see the Star Trek version of the world than I would the Soylent Green version of the world.
Then read some by Bucky Fuller.
Buckminster Fuller was one of the most optimistic people. He said, as we get on, we have done more with less. And if we do it responsibly, we can do a lot more with a lot less.
Well, that's the future of mankind.
That's Jesus' view as well. It's a hopeful view. It's always the hopeful view. We always have that to look up to, and we always have that to shine before others. That there's hope. It's not a cynical, dying off type thing. It's a hopeful promise. With God's help, we will be able to affect these things. But if we start looking away from God and saying, what's in there for myself? Then we know the balance will fall out again. We know the bottom falls out. It always does. And so when we look toward the greater society,